Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. This 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak a little slowly, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. Today, Brian Lynn and I tell about a new Hollywood movie shot entirely on an iPhone. We also listen to another segment of a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. And we close the show, as always, with an American story. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Some humanitarian groups in South Korea are using unusual ways to send food aid and information to people in North Korea. Their efforts come as officials from the North and the South prepare for talks between the leaders of the two countries. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is expected to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Panmunjom on April 27th. Recently, activists gathered on Ganghwa Island in the Yellow Sea, close to the border dividing North and South Korea. The group included volunteers, humanitarian activists, and North Korean defectors. They launched packages containing aid into the sea. The packages look like plastic bottles. They are filled with rice, medicine, and American money. The group is also sending information on digital memory devices, which contain movies as well as foreign news reports, which are banned in North Korea. The activists say the ocean current will carry the sealed containers to cities and towns on North Korea's west coast. Park Jung-ho told VOA, "If we set the date and time right, it will get there 100%. Park is with the Kwensem Education Center in Seoul. The center helps North Korean defectors deal with life after they move to South Korea. Park said, "Using the ocean current is a safer and better way to send things to the north than using balloons. Humanitarian groups have used balloons in the past with mixed results. Balloons were used to send packages containing South Korean movies, television shows, and news, materials that are banned in North Korea. In 2014, North and South Korean forces exchanged gunfire when an activist group launched balloons full of leaflets toward the North Korean border. The incident almost interfered with plans at the time to hold a reunion of families that were separated by the Korean War. As diplomatic efforts increase before the meeting of the North and South Korean leaders, there has been less attention to the group's activities. This week, the group also sent more than 500 kilograms of rice in addition to digital information. They have done so repeatedly over the past 3 years. The United Nations reports that more than 40% of North Korea's population does not get enough to eat. Conditions in the North have improved since the 1990s, when the communist agriculture system failed. Widespread starvation followed. But food shortages remain common. Some observers are concerned about the international campaign of pressure and economic sanctions against North Korea. The sanctions are aimed at persuading the North to give up its nuclear weapons program. But observers are worried such measures will increase hunger and poverty in the country. Many aid activists are defectors from North Korea. They escaped poverty and repression, and now want to bring international attention to human rights abuses in the North. Jung Kwang-il is a defector who recently met with United States President Donald Trump during a visit to Washington. He included a copy of Trump's speech to the United Nations as part of the information package the group sent to North Korea. In the speech, the president threatens to destroy the North if it continues to threaten the world with its nuclear weapons program. Jung said, "So the message that we are sending to them is that the U.S. president knows that you are living in these harsh conditions." The North Korean defectors involved in the effort have raised money and donated their time. Kim Yong-hwa is with the North Korean Refugees Human Rights Association of Korea in Seoul. He said it was a difficult thing to do, but is pleased he sent the materials. Some of the humanitarian support comes from Christian religious groups. Religious teaching in North Korea is highly restricted. I'm Mario Ritter.
For many people, smartphones have replaced cameras as the main way to capture personal pictures and video. The quality of the devices has greatly improved. Even some Hollywood filmmakers have decided to stop using big, costly equipment and instead shoot movies on smartphones. One of the latest to do this is director and producer Steven Soderbergh. Soderbergh has made both independent and big-budget films. He won an Academy Award for Best Director of the movie Traffic in 2001. He was also nominated that year for Best Director for Aaron Brockovich. His earliest full-length movie, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, came out in 1989. Ocean's 11 came out 4 years later. Among other Soderbergh films are 2012's Magic Mike and Logan Lucky, released last year. Soderbergh has also worked on several television series.
He describes his latest directorial effort, Unsane, as a psychological thriller. The film was recently released in the U.S. and several other countries. The whole film was shot on an iPhone 7 Plus. Actress Claire Foy plays a woman who moves to a new city to escape a man who has been stalking her. After experiencing mental health difficulties, she agrees to go to a hospital. The woman quickly decides she should not be in the mental hospital and tries to leave, but she is not permitted to go. She protests her detention. Her mother also works to get her out. While trapped there, the woman fears her stalker now works at the hospital. It is not clear to the moviegoers if the man is really there or if the character just imagines that.
In several interviews, the director praised his results of iPhone filming. "I'm very happy the way the movie looks," Soderbergh told a news conference for the film's premiere at the Berlin International Film Festival in Germany. He said he knows some people will want to see the movie just because it was shot on an iPhone. But, he says, moviegoers will not notice anything unusual. Anybody going to see this movie who has no idea of the backstory to the production will have no idea this was shot on the phone, the filmmaker told IndieWire. "I've seen it 40 feet tall," Soderbergh said of Unsane. "It looks like velvet." He added that he thinks shooting movies on an iPhone or similar device is a game changer for filmmaking. He said it was a good experience, and he would find it hard to return to the use of usual movie cameras. Soderbergh said one of the best things about using an iPhone is that it greatly speeds up shooting. The camera can be moved anywhere in a matter of seconds. Unsane was completely shot in just 2 weeks. The director said it was also helpful not to have to make big holes in walls to fit large cameras or attach equipment to the ceiling. He added that one of the only issues he had was that the iPhone was sometimes affected by strong vibrations.
Joshua Leonard was an actor in the movie. He said being filmed with an iPhone provided fewer distractions during filming. This permitted him to, in his words, stay in the world of the film and in the world of our characters. He added, "There's nothing more fun as an actor than just being in the thick of the creative process when you're actually on set, and not having to wait for the machine of filmmaking to catch up with the creative impulse." Leonard said it also helped his performance because he is already used to so many people putting phones close to his face to take pictures. Soderbergh thinks this same idea will help many people develop a deeper connection to the movie. He says this is because people are already completely used to seeing camera phone imagery. In his words, "I think without even knowing it, there's an intimacy between the viewer and the screen in this case because of that familiarity." Soderbergh is currently working on another iPhone-filmed movie. That basketball-related film, High Flying Bird, is to be released next year. Next up, What It Takes. Today, host Alice Winkler features Frank Gehry, arguably the most famous architect in the world. In this small segment, Winkler is exploring what inspired Gehry's designs.
He found his inspiration for the future in classical Greek sculpture, the Elgin marbles specifically, that once graced the top of the Parthenon.
So if you look at the Elgin marbles, those warriors are pressing the shields into the stone, and you feel the pressure, and you feel the horses are moving, and you feel the... And if they could do that with inert materials, I thought, why not see if that could become an architectural direction that would enliven the buildings, humanize them, and create humanity.
In other words, Gary wasn't interested in the specific designs of the Elgin marbles. He was just stirred by how solid materials could be made to express movement. And movement, for Gary, was an essential component of feeling, of play. And he found a perfect vehicle for expressing all of that in the undulating form of a fish. Picture the way a fish moves, the way its body can gently fold side to side. As Gary points out, Michelangelo spent years practicing drawing folds. He wanted to achieve the flowing feel of fabric in his work. There's just something very powerful, Gary says, about a fold.
And you know, the reason is when you're a baby, you're in your mother's arms and you're in the fold. And there's something primitive, beautiful, and humanity about it. And I thought, the Greeks knew how to express it. Can we do that in architecture? And the fish became, because I used it as a title, I said that, I then started to sketch fish and realized that there was something there to look at, emulate, and try to play with.
You can find the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
From VOA Learning English, this is American Stories. Our story is called The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. It was written by Stephen Crane. Today, we will hear the second and final part of the story.
"Don't know whether there'll be a fight or not," answered one man firmly. "But there'll be some shooting, some good shooting."
The young man who had warned them waved his hand. "Oh, there'll be a fight fast enough if anyone wants it. Anybody can get in a fight out there in the street. There's a fight just waiting."
The salesman seemed to be realizing the possibility of personal danger.
"What did you say his name was?" he asked.
"Scratchy Wilson," voices answered together.
"And will he kill anybody? What are you going to do? Does this happen often? Can he break in that door?"
"No, he can't break in that door," replied the saloon keeper. "He's tried it 3 times. But when he comes, you better lie down on the floor, stranger. He's sure to shoot at the door, and a bullet may come through."
After that, the salesman watched the door steadily. The time had not yet come for him to drop to the floor, but he carefully moved near the wall.
"Will he kill anybody?" he asked again. The men laughed without humor at the question. "He's here to shoot, and he's here for trouble. I don't see any good in experimenting with him."
"But what do you do in a situation like this? What can you do?"
a man answered. "Well, he and Jack Potter..."
"But..."
the other men interrupted together. "Jack Potter's in San Antonio."
"Well, who is he? What's he got to do with this?"
"Oh, he's the town policeman. He goes out and fights Scratchy when he starts acting this way."
A nervous, waiting silence was upon them. The salesman saw that the saloon keeper, without a sound, had taken a gun from a hiding place. Then he saw the man signal to him, so he moved across the room.
"You better come with me behind this table."
"No thanks," said the salesman. "I'd rather be where I can get out the back door." At that, the saloon keeper made a kindly but forceful motion.
The salesman obeyed, and found himself seated on a box with his head below the level of the table. The saloon keeper sat comfortably upon a box nearby.
You see, he whispered, Scratchy Wilson is a wonder with a gun. A perfect wonder. And when he gets excited, everyone gets out of his path. He's a terror when he's drunk. When he's not drinking, he's all right. Wouldn't hurt anything. Nicest fella in town. But when he's drunk, be careful. There were periods of stillness. I wish Jack Potter were back from San Antonio, said the saloon keeper. He shot Wilson once, in the leg. He'd come in and take care of this thing. Soon, they heard from a distance the sound of a shot, followed by three wild screams. The men looked at each other. Here he comes, they said. A man in a red shirt turned a corner and walked into the middle of the main street of Yellow Sky. In each hand, the man held a long, heavy, blue-black gun. Often he screamed, and these cries rang through the seemingly deserted village. The screams sounded sharply over the roofs with a power that seemed to have no relation to the ordinary strength of a man's voice. These fierce cries rang against walls of silence. The man's face flamed in a hot anger born of whiskey. His eyes, rolling but watchful, hunted the still doorways and windows. He walked with the movement of a midnight cat. As the thoughts came to him, he roared threatening information. The long guns hung from his hands like feathers. They were moved with electric speed. The muscles of his neck straightened and sank as passion moved him. The only sounds were his terrible invitations to battle. The calm houses preserved their dignity at the passing of this small thing in the middle of the street. There was no offer of fight, no offer of fight. The man called to the sky. There were no answers. He screamed and shouted and waved his guns here and everywhere. Finally, the man was at the closed door of the saloon. He went to it and, beating upon it with his gun, demanded drink. The door remained closed. He picked up a bit of paper from the street and nailed it to the frame of the door with a knife. Then he turned his back upon the place and walked to the opposite side of the street. Turning quickly and easily, he fired the guns at the bit of paper. He missed it by half an inch. He cursed at himself and went away. Later, he comfortably shot out all the windows of the house of his best friend. Scratchy was playing with this town. It was a toy for him. But still, there was no offer of fight. The name of Jack Potter, his ancient enemy, entered his mind. He decided that it would be a good thing if he went to Potter's house and, by shooting at it, make him come out and fight. He moved in the direction of his desire, singing some sort of war song. When he arrived at it, Potter's house presented the same still front as had the other homes. Taking a good position, the man screamed an invitation to battle. But this house regarded him as a great stone god might have done. It gave no sign. After a little wait, the man screamed more invitations, mixing them with wonderful curses. After a while came the sight of a man working himself into deepest anger over the stillness of a house. He screamed at it. He shot again and again. He paused only for breath or to reload his guns. Potter and his bride walked rapidly. Sometimes they laughed together, quietly and a little foolishly.
"Next corner, dear," he said finally.
They put forth the efforts of a pair walking against a strong wind. Potter was ready to point the first appearance of the new home. Then, as they turned the corner, they came face to face with the man in the red shirt, who was feverishly loading a large gun. Immediately, the man dropped his empty gun to the ground and, like lightning, pulled out another. The second gun was aimed at Potter's chest. There was a silence.
Potter couldn't open his mouth. Quickly, he loosened his arm from the woman's grasp and dropped the bag to the sand. As for the bride, her face had become the color of an old cloth. She was motionless. The two men faced each other at a distance of 9 feet. Behind the gun, Wilson smiled with a new and quiet cruelty. "Tried to surprise me," he said. "Tried to surprise me." His eyes grew more evil. As Potter made a slight movement, the man pushed his gun sharply forward. "No, don't you do it, Jack Potter. Don't you move a finger toward a gun yet. Don't you move a muscle. The time has come for me to settle with you, and I'm going to do it my own way, slowly, with no interruption. So just listen to what I tell you." Potter looked at his enemy. "I haven't got a gun with me, Scratchy," he said. "Honest, I haven't." He was stiffening and steadying. But at the back of his mind floated a picture of the beautiful car on the train. He thought of the glory of the wedding, the spirit of his new life. "You know I fight when I have to fight, Scratchy Wilson. But I haven't got a gun with me. You have to do all the shooting yourself." His enemy's face turned pale with anger. He stepped forward and whipped his gun back and forth before Potter's chest. "Don't you tell me you haven't got a gun with you, you dog! Don't you tell me a lie like that! There isn't a man in Texas who ever saw you without a gun! Don't think I'm a kid!" His eyes burned with anger and his breath came heavily. "I don't think you're a kid," answered Potter. His feet had not moved an inch backward. "I think you're a complete fool. I tell you I haven't got a gun and I haven't. If you're going to shoot me, you better begin now. You'll never get a chance like this again." So much enforced reasoning had weakened Wilson's anger. He was calmer.
"If you haven't got a gun, why haven't you got a gun?"
he asked.
"Been to church?"
"I haven't got a gun because I've just come from San Antonio with my wife. I'm married," said Potter. "And if I had thought there'd be a fool like you here when I brought my wife home, I would have had a gun, and don't you forget it."
"Married?"
said Scratchy, not at all understanding. "Yes, married. I'm married," said Potter clearly.
"Married?"
said Scratchy. Seemingly for the first time, he saw the pale, frightened woman at the other side.
"No!"
he said. He was like a creature allowed a glance at another world. He moved a pace backward, and his arm with the gun dropped to his side.
"Is this the lady?"
he asked.
"Yes, this is the lady," answered Potter.
There was another period of silence.
"Well," said Wilson at last, slowly, "I suppose we won't fight now."
"We won't if you say so, Scratchy. You know, I didn't make the trouble."
Potter lifted the bag.
"Well, I guess we won't fight, Jack," said Wilson.
He was looking at the ground.
"Married."
He was not a student of good manners. It was merely that in the presence of this foreign condition, he was a simple child of the wildlands. He picked up his fallen gun, and he went away. His feet made deep tracks in the heavy sand.
You just heard the second and final part of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by American writer Stephen Crane. We have come to the end of today's show, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you will be back too. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.